Today is the 10th of February, approximately 3:35 in the afternoon. Members who are present at this time, Senator Davis, Senator Huggins, and myself, Senator Terrio. The only item that we have for action today or to for the overview is the issue of House Bill 242, which passed in 2001, setting up a program where retirees could return to state employment. And we have a couple of people here to testify from the administration. I think we're going to start with Melanie Milhorn.
Good afternoon. Thank you, members of Senate State Affairs. We appreciate the opportunity to come and present you with a report on House Bill 242, Senate Bill 149, and just a little bit of the brief background. In 2001, the 21st legislature enacted House Bill 242, Senate Bill 149, and Senate Bill 149 was first introduced by Senator Lorne Lehman, and the underlying basis for that was to provide management with a recruitment and retention tool to be able to have teachers who were in a normal retirement period to be able to incentivize them to return to work. And shortly thereafter, House Bill 242 was introduced by Representative Pete Cott, which expanded the opportunity for normal retirement PERS employers to be able to come back, return to work under this program. And so the statutes were amended to allow TERS and PERS member to come back to employment by waiving participation in the PERS and TERS retirement programs. And once participation was waived, the employees did not make a contribution to PERS or TERS, nor did their employers. The legislation is scheduled to sunset on July 1 of 2005. And the report that we've provided to the legislature provides a detailed summary about the program itself to date and the use of that program to date. And in brief summary, during the course of the retiree program, approximately 56% of all TERS employers participated with 187 waivers that were filed.
Sorry, could you say that number again?
There were 56% of all TERS employers who participated with 187 waivers filed. And currently, as of November 30th, 2004, there are 124 members who remain employed under TERS. And 26% of all PERS employers have participated with 297 waivers filed. And as of November 30th, 2004, there are approximately 211 retirees still employed under this program. On September 14th of 2004, there was an Attorney General opinion that was provided to the Division of Retirement and Benefits. It's contained in the report. And the AG opinion determined that once the reemployment amendments to PERS and TERS statute sunset on July 1 of 2005, that the reemployed retirees can no longer receive retirement benefits while employed by a PERS or TERS employer. And if employees continue in their employment with PERS or TERS, it would require them to begin making contributions to PERS or TERS, and it would stop their retirement payment.
Says and? If you contribute, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
If you're drawing retirement, in order to continue to draw the retirement, you would have to contribute. But even if you contribute, your retirement will be terminated. Is that what you said?
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Huggins, what it would do is that as of that date right now, based on the AG opinion, is that if the individual wanted to continue to be employed by that PERS or TERS member, their pension benefit would cease. and they would need to make contributions to the PERS or TERS system, and their employer would be required to make contributions as well.
So basically, they go back into a regular employee status.
Correct.
And they will add years of service to their retirement for when they start collecting again.
That's correct. What it does is it would begin their contribution again, and they would start to earn service credit for a second retirement benefit. So they're separate. So if you work for 20 years, and then you were enrolled under House Bill 242, you would come and work another 3 years. And then as of July 1 of 2001, unless the legislature extends this program and or allows those parties who are currently enrolled to continue that benefit, it would cease as of that date. They could work another 3 years. They would get another 3 years of service, and they would get a second benefit that would be calculated separately and added to their first retirement benefit.
You know,
when they retired the second time.
If I had not participated in this program and had just gone into retirement and then decided later on I was bored in retirement, want to get back into the employment, came back to work, would I start accruing a second retirement similar to what you've just explained, or would I just add to my existing years of service for when I went back into retirement?
And that contemplates, just for clarification, that it doesn't involve House Bill 242 right now.
I never went back to work under 242.
Okay.
I just went into retirement, then back into state employment.
You would end up with your first retirement benefit, and then you would go on to earn a second retirement benefit. And then when you retired the second time, they would both be combined together. So those two periods, two different segments. We've had employees come back and do that very thing three, four times and have four separate retirement periods that are discrete and separate and added together at the end.
Go ahead, sir.
After the expiration, sunset has happened, you still can rehire retirees, or you're precluded as the employer?
If the legislature takes no action to continue the program or to allow the parties who are currently enrolled to continue to receive that benefit, then there is no new entrance into the program. That July 1 of 2005, that sunset provision will repeal that opportunity for any members going forward, and it will also have the impact of the existing parties who are enrolled to stop that program if the legislature does not take any action to continue the program and or allow those parties to continue receiving the benefit.
But if they choose...
Go ahead. Actually, today I'd like to just be a little bit more informed.
If they choose, though, they can then continue work, but they would not draw the benefit. If the job was still available, they could still be employed.
Through the chair, Senator Davis, that is absolutely correct.
And the agencies have always had that ability.
Right.
Can you tell me, when 242 was passed, the company's fiscal notes, I didn't have a chance to track those down. I'm not sure if they were contained here in the report. What did they anticipate the level of participation would be? Or did they hazard a guess at the time?
No, they didn't. And the fiscal note actually for House Bill 242 has two components to it. One was the retiree return provision that allowed those parties to enroll in the program via this waiver program. The other part was medical enhancements that accompanied House Bill 242. And so benefits were enhanced for police and firefighters after 20 years of service and for teachers after 25 years of service. For police and firefighters, they had system pay medical. And for teachers, 5 years of service, they received system paid medical as well. So the fiscal note, and for Tier 3, after 60 years, they received system-paid medical without paying half of the premium. So the fiscal note reflects a 0.17% of payroll costs only for the medical enhancement portion.
And has there been any, does the report, and my apologies, I just did not have a chance to read through this, does it add up all of the employee and employer contributions that were not made, that were saved under 242? Because I know there's concern in the building that continuation of this program, and if it were allowed to expand, means that we have a growing portion of our employee base that they're acting, filling the role of a state employee, but not making any contribution into the system that's currently underwater. And there's concern with that. So I'm just wondering, for the distinct time period that, we've lived through under 242, what amount, if all those positions had been filled, with employees making the contribution, what additional contribution would there have been made into the system by the two components?
And in response to your question, we have not calculated that, and that's not in the report. We certainly could do that if it's, if that is something you would like us to do.
Yeah, I think that would be beneficial, and I think if we don't supply the answer here, it's probably going to be a question that would be asked of you up in finance. So if we could get that, that would be helpful. Now, we've interrupted you with questions here. Are there other portions of the report that you want to just walk us through?
Well, I wanted to also, with regard to the report, what we've done after we got the AG opinion is that we noticed all of the employers for PERS and TERS in September. There's a letter contained in here that went to all of the employers, and in addition, a letter went to all of the members who are enrolled in September to notice them, provide them with a copy of the AG opinion so that they were properly prepared for how they might deal with this particular circumstance. So I think it's important that everyone has been given that opportunity to read the AG opinion and determine, you know, what that means to them personally. And also, they know that they can contact the legislature in support of extending the program. So that information is in there. There's detailed information about how the program has been used by the different employers, who's participated by job classification, percentages, for PERS, primarily the parties who have come back under the retiree return program have included biologists and engineers. Those are two classification areas that are very difficult for the employer to recruit and retain for those positions. With regard to teachers, there were 87 teachers in 23 rural school districts who came back under this program. They've also had a very effective mentoring program where the teacher initially comes back under the retiree return, will stay there for a period of time, will mentor a less experienced teacher, and then will exit the program. So,
and we just heard in the Transportation Committee from the commissioner that he is having difficulty keeping or hiring some of the professionals that you mentioned. Do you have any sense that in TERS, whether it's the same situation really was 242 abused, misused at all, or have you done any evaluation?
We have not heard any issues. The division has not that it's been abused or there are those types of issues associated with that. One thing that the TERS statute set out was that the employer needed to provide a resolution by the school board that they had recruitment and retention issues in various different areas. So they put that forward first, in order to bring a teacher back under House Bill 242, there was not such a requirement that was placed on the PERS employers. And also, Mercer in September provided a fiscal analysis based on the participation level to date, and then they tiered the participation level. So it started out at 100 members, and then it goes to 500 members, and then up to 1,000 in order to determine at the various different levels what happens to the system. And what they determined based on the participation level for PERS is that the costs have been negligible to the system. Under TERS, because they have a higher level of unfunded liability, and at approximately 124 members participating, it has had a fiscal impact of approximately $100,000. We also would support, if the legislature enacts legislation going forward to continue that program, our recommendation would be, and we have a methodology that would be able to address that, to hold the systems harmless by taking the payroll dollars and incorporating those payroll dollars for purposes of reducing the past service costs. So we have talked to our actuarial consultant. We have that methodology that's available to us, and we would recommend that language be incorporated in any of the bills that extend the program.
And this is just an overview, but have the bills been put into the system? They're currently on both sides of the body.
There's a couple of bills that have been introduced right now regarding House Bill 242. And one is with Senator Gary Stevens, and the other is with Senator Kim Elton, to extend the period of time.
And so the language that you just talked about is included in the current wording in the system, or something that you would propose be added?
We've talked to both of the bill sponsors about inclusion of language that would address and hold the systems harmless.
Do we have further questions?
Mr. Chair, Melanie, sounds like that you're supporting that the concept of extending this is a cost-saving mechanism that appears to have merit. Is that accurate?
We do support this program. I think that we found in talking to the different employers, depending on the employers, that it has been used in various different areas as a very good management tool. And so our principal concern is to ensure that no additional costs are added to the system. And by allowing an employer to have flexibility in particular areas where they have recruitment and retention issues right now, and to provide that relief valve, and I think it was good that the legislature also said, let's revisit this. Let's look at what this was accomplishing as far as the goals and objectives. And so I think this is a very good review process. And I think you'll find, depending on the employer that you talk to, it has been beneficial for them. And depending, again, on the various different employers, they have found that to be effective.
In the case of the young person that's trying to get into the workforce and they're viewing this externally, they're on the hire list, the wait list, organizationally, and they look internal to the organization, they're anticipating a person retiring, and the net effect is that they remain on the to-hire list, and the person that retired is rehired. Is that big problem, little problem, no problem?
I think you have to look at it on a case-by-case basis, and I think there are discrete circumstances where that has been a problem. There are other areas where it's not an issue, so you really do have to look at it on a case-by-case basis.
In your estimation, as far as a trend, as far as people, I mean, the average Alaskan that's looking for a job, that's not employed or is looking to get into a new field?
I would go back to looking at that on a case-by-case basis, but if someone is new into the profession, for example, a lot of those positions that an individual may have come back to are going to be in their various respective classifications, probably senior level kinds of positions, or certainly journey level in some instances. So when you're looking at an engineer or perhaps a biologist, I think there's still growth available. But I have heard that concern.
Sure. Has there also been any kind of evaluation, and I think this sort of dovetails with the question here, that if you forestall by having the retired folks continue, sort of the normal hiring of new people, so you have a real blend of people within the system at different levels of experience, but you can only go out so far because people only want to work so far, that when they finally do take retirement along with the other people that would take the natural retirement and stay out, will you cause yourself a drastic brain drain at that time, that the departments that are struggling with bringing in people, again, maintaining a mixture of levels of experience, and so you've saved yourself some money in the short haul, but created a position down the road. Did you follow that?
I think it really does. It needs both. You need to have an infusion and opportunities made available for new workers. You also need to evaluate your programmatic needs, and if you have someone who certainly is able to retire and are intending to do so, they either step out of the employment market for a period of time, or programmatically you've looked at that and you recognize that you have recruitment and retention associated with that, it allows you an opportunity to bring that person back and address your programmatic needs. So I think it really takes both. New employees coming into the system and providing value there, and also an opportunity on a case-by-case basis as a management tool to be able to incentivize someone to come back and return.
I mean, clearly, the state employee has the right to leave state service, collect their retirement, continue to work, but in the private sector. So, in effect, they're getting their retirement and a salary.
Sure.
And lots of state employees do that.
Mm-hmm.
But if we want to retain them, we're barred from letting them experience the same type of double compensation.
Right, exactly. And I think that holds true, especially in the area of biologists for fish and game, for example, retire with the state. The compensation's good at the federal level, and you lose them to that opportunity. It's not uncommon to have that happen. So they are a prime beneficiary, I think, of this kind of opportunity.
Are there any constraints in the different fields whereby you could have 10% rehire, 20%, or if we had any constraints like that, even if it's only by a different commodity area where that particular supervisor issued that guidance?
Those types of decisions are made by the individual agencies, and they have had their own different kinds of guidelines. So if an agency, for example, wants to bring somebody back or has that desire, they have to go to their director or, in some cases, their commissioner. How does the commissioner wish to apply criteria about using the retiree return program? And so I think you will find by different agencies there's guidelines that they have established that indicate a yes, or in this case no, or what that criterion is. But there is nothing formally for all agencies. It's an individual agency decision about how they're going to use the program.
You know, some of the concerns that I've heard from people is that everyone likes to have an experienced workforce. And you get in a comfort zone with known people that you have in your workforce. So when it gets near retirement, there may be some apprehension based on the association, but the professional, if the person is fixed and retired. Then in the hiring practice, if you have a new person that walks in, just graduated, whatever the case may be, you interview them. Number one, it's the same old cycle of what's your experience? Well, no, I just graduated. Well, you can't get any experience unless you are have a job. But, oh, by the way, the person you've been working or has been your subordinate for the last 10 years, 5 years, whatever the number is, your comfort zone with that person to rehire them is obviously much different than the new person. And, I mean, I've heard a number of people say that, but in the same token, if you're looking at it pragmatically, say, well, you know, we'd like to be able to keep as many experienced people as you have. Is your thoughts about that sort of dilemma when we look at it from a managerial oversight?
And I, in my current position right now, my function is really to ensure that the parties who participate in the program comply with the statutory provisions. So I've not been involved. I had previously worked in human resources, and in those particular cases, I had some experience there, but it was really dependent on the hiring manager and in, you know, what the director's view of House Bill 242 was, and what, on a case-by-case basis, what their needs were. I mean, they would do an assessment to know that the position is difficult to recruit for, or recruit for the position, and determine, you know, this is not, I need very key skills, experience, and training associated with this position. And then they look at that applicant pool and make a decision on, you know, who they're going to appoint to the position.
The I see here on page 4 it talks about the, let's see, 123 active state employees worked on the waiver program. Of these, 78 returned to work in a position at a salary lower than the salary they earned prior to their retirement. 22 at the same retirement, or at the same salary, and 23 at a position of a higher salary. I know there's certainly good reason for some of those, and an example might be a commissioner that worked in a department at different jobs throughout their 20 plus years, or whatever number of years before they retired. Maybe they've been retired for a number of years, happily retired. New governor comes in, he wants somebody that really has a good overview of the departments that are working for the department. Somebody that's put that amount of time in is ideal. They hire him and they come in as the commissioner's salary. Now, mind you, I know that commissioner's salary is less than some of the employees within the department. But so there's perhaps good reason on specific cases, but is there any concern or any thought given to, well, you can come back to work, but it's going to have to be at the same salary or lower? Any kind of limitations that have been considered either on types of employees, you know, if we specifically need to bring back or retain people in specific levels of expertise, that we need to reauthorize this with them in mind, or some of these political appointees where you really do want somebody that's spent their working life in the department. Has the administration given much thought to ways of limiting the application of this? Come on forward.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Kevin Brooks. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration. And in fact, we have had protracted discussions about, you know, what works with the program and what doesn't. I think going forward, some of the things we talked about is really demonstrating and getting to, you know, the question that Senator Huggins had, really demonstrating is there a recruitment difficulty here? And maybe only utilizing the program where you could demonstrate recruitment difficulties, thereby not artificially blocking promotional opportunities for candidates. There have been discussions with PEG. You've articulated at least a handful of cases that are currently in existence where you have appointees of the administration who've been brought back in after some period of retirement into jobs that perhaps paid higher than when they left. But there's not a hard and fast rule, and Melanie talked about circumstances may dictate. I know from my years at Fish and Game, when I worked there, we were losing biologists at a very fast clip to the federal government because they could go to work there and make better pay, and there's a 25% cost of living that was tax-free. And you know, there were financial motivations there that, you know, it was difficult for the state to compete with. And so you saw agencies like Fish and Game and DOT that had really significant recruitment and retention difficulties really actively utilize the program as it was developed in HB 242. Other departments like administration where I'm at now, I think we have two or three, whereas those departments, DOT and Fish and Game primarily, were upwards of 30 each. And so different departments were responding to their own situations in, you know, in different ways, and either aggressively utilizing the plan or maybe more strategically using it. But it does run the gamut. It's hard to establish a certain specific set of rules that would address every instance. And so I think we were looking at general policies of how we would go forward, but it's along the lines of things I've just kind of spoken about, if that's helpful.
Other questions from committee members? Yeah, can you tell me, and I think we have somebody here from the Department of Law maybe to answer specific questions, is there any difference of opinion or disagreements with the AG's conclusions here on how, what happens if in fact the existing program sunsets?
You know, Mr. Chairman, we had discussions. I think we defer to the expert advice that we get from the Department of Law. I mean, I think early on we had envision this like previous RIP plans, for instance, where people RIPed when the RIP bill sunsetted, they didn't un-RIP. But the way the legislation is written, you know, the ruling is as it is, and I think we have consensus that going forward it does require, if the program is to continue, we either need to extend the sunset to allow new members, but also have to address this group of people that have currently participated in the program who will otherwise return to active status after July 1st, as Melanie has discussed with you earlier.
And so if the legislature decided to continue the program but put some parameters on it that you had to show, you know, recruitment problems, what would that have? I'm trying to think of how that would impact a person that's perhaps already in the program that would not have met that criteria originally.
Off the cuff, I would have to think that would be prospective to people, new people coming in. One thing that we are dealing with, and again, something we've discussed, is these are all people that have retired at one point, and so at some point, they're going to retire again. That's probably going to happen sooner than later because they've already qualified either by age or length of service to retire once. So through a natural progression, these aren't people who are likely to be long-tenured employees, although it's not inconceivable for someone, say, a trooper who retired after 20 years in their mid-40s to work a significant period of time. But by and large, I think we're dealing with a demographic that's an older group of employees.
Would you be able to supply us with any of that demographic information? Or?
Give you demographics of groups. We can't give it to you about individuals, but certainly we could give you groupings.
Yeah, I think that would be that would be useful, because you can certainly think, figure out that those people that did start with their state employment early and were able to retire, quote-unquote, at 45 or 50, they would have an incentive to stay working, you know, continue to work. They probably still have kids, maybe in high school, going to college, and you know, certainly not be ready to retire. So it'd be interesting to see whether demographics point that we've got any particular age group that took advantage of this. So
hopefully we can pull that together and get it to the committee.
And one other thing that I think is sort of something perhaps legislators need to keep in mind, if there is any real motion or movement to go towards a new tier, the quicker that you can get your base to transfer over to the new tier, the better. So if there's any kind of interim between now and the establishment of a new tier, if you can have existing employees bridge that gap so that all your new employees, your turnover, real turnover, takes place when there's a new tier, that's beneficial.
That's a good point, Mr. Chairman, and actually, you know, the sunset provision does provide that, and I think going forward, if assuming there was legislation that went forward to extend the program, I think it would be fair to say that, because I think there was maybe a bit of confusion with people participating, whether they continued or not beyond June 30th, 2005, if there was a bill and it said, this bill sunset, and sunset means all active people are not, either go away or you have to become an active employee. You could clarify that. It gives people enough of a window to understand what the rules are. I don't think then you have a problem, and it's still, through that sunset clause, you have the ability then to manage just what you're saying, a conversion of your lord's earlier tier employees to a new tier. And it provides a time certain where that could be reviewed and see what the benefits of the programs are at some certain point in time in the future.
Okay. And just, again, on the AG's opinion, has there been any comment back from any of the bargaining units that they disagree with this opinion?
Not in disagreeing with the opinion. I mean, the bargaining units, we've heard both sides, some talking about barriers to promotion and others thinking it's a good thing. I mean, I can't really speak for the different unions, but I think there's a diverse set of opinions out there on this.
And does this report contain, I guess, actually, yeah, we've got the numbers here, the savings. So. Do we have other questions? Go ahead.
People that are still employed on the provisional that would be affected by the sunset. If you were characterized, in your opinion, would be a degree of bitterness because they thought that their expectation had not been realized, or somebody short-circuited, or how would you characterize the average employee?
I would say that there were a number of members who, at the time that they were going to participate in the program, and based on the division's interpretation of that statute beginning in 2001 when this legislation was enacted, if they contacted the division, we would have told them that, yes, they got to continue this benefit because that was our interpretation and that was our understanding until we received AG opinion in September. And we have received a number of letters from the different members who are currently enrolled who have indicated, I made life plans based on what you have told me, and so they would be, and they have expressed frustration and anger, and for that the division apologizes. That was our understanding, that was our interpretation. We were relying on a different opinion that we had been provided with. It was an AG. It was verbal. It wasn't in writing. So that was the information that we relied on when people asked us.
Was that communicated to them in writing, or it was just verbal?
It was both. We provided that information in our seminar setting. We would have verbally have told individuals that. We would have provided email correspondence, and there are records of that, and employers have provided that back to us, saying, how could you have told us in 2002 that this person got to continue this benefit, and now, as of September of 2004, there's a completely contrary opinion that is legally binding.
And what kind of potential liabilities do we have? Has there been an opinion rendered on that?
No. There's no attempt really to quantify. I mean, we can quantify to the extent that there's X number of people out there, you know, speculating on what someone might do after June 30th. We've also had employees come to us and say, yeah, we fully expected at the end of June 30th, 2005, that this was going to be over and, you know, we got to go away. So there was a difference, and different people had a different opinion of it. So it's kind of hard to quantify what a potential liability might be.
And if we were, well, would you have a way of knowing who got what letters? So we're not relying on, well, who's contacted you back and say, wait a minute, this is not what I was told. We wouldn't have to rely on that, because if there were to be litigation, it'd be likely a class action.
Right.
And we wouldn't know until then what the potential population is, unless you have some way.
John, I guess I'd have to defer to Melanie to know what kind of records we have on individuals to see what written advice was provided. I really don't know.
And we do have some records right now where the various different individuals have indicated it's this counselor with this name, with this date, and I received this information. So we have those kinds of written records. We also acknowledge that if the individual would have contacted us, that that's what we would have said to them, either verbally or verbally, primarily.
In its entirety, we're talking, I think, 200 and some PERS employees and 100, and so 400 is the total population. It's not overwhelmingly large, but certainly still a significant number.
Senator Huggins?
Well, but we still have at our disposal a number of flexible mechanisms. Let's just take one. We could grandfather everybody that's presently employed. Is that accurate?
That's correct.
Legal. Or we could grandfather them for a year or 18 months, or ask for volunteers that wanted to terminate anyway and look at shaping the group. I mean, I think most people that look at this sort of shakes their head in some respects, but they want to do the right thing. But, you know, I, for one, having listened to people that say, golly, you can't get in this system because all the old guys hang around forever. And when they retire, they just continue to hang around. But in the same token, if you're a supervisor and you're rehiring those people legitimately, I mean, that's good rationale. I over time, I saw some real scandalous situations where federal government kinds of people were transferring and recreating jobs and what have you, and it was a self-proliferating thing if you just worked the mechanism, and a lot of safeguards would put into place because you could see the track records. I don't think that's present here, but in the same token, on the other end, I'm concerned about we grow this larger and larger bubble of older employees, and then suddenly they're gone, and we still have the problem of getting new employees on qualification, engineers. And I would assume that Purdue University is still producing lots of engineers that want a job.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things we've talked about, and really on a more general terms, not just in regards to a retiree program, but in the demographics of baby boomers starting to really enter into the out of the workforce into the retirement realms, is having succession planning and knowledge transfers and things of that nature, so that we can systematically try to manage the workforce better and be mentoring and bringing on younger workers to replace the aging workforce, because it's a demographic that the entire country is facing, not just the state of Alaska. So it has a broader ramification than just the applications of this particular program. It's certainly something we're aware of and trying to address.
Senator Davis, did you have a question?
Yes. I just want you to go back, and I'm going to repeat what I think has happened here. When this program went into place, it was your understanding, and you had prepared literature and give seminars saying that they would be able to stay within the system even when the sunset ended and was not extended. Is that right?
That is correct.
Well, when was it that you decided to get the AG's opinion? When did you find out that that wasn't correct?
We asked the questions back in September, and that's when we received an AG opinion.
September 04.
September 2004, that's correct.
At what point triggered something to advise you to get an opinion?
This request was initiated not actually formally by the division, because that was our understanding and that was the interpretation. Actually, there was a request by another director who was the director of Division of Personnel, mm-hmm. and she contacted the Department of Law, and she wanted to know that question. And so that triggered it. If actually she hadn't have asked that question, the division would have continued on with its interpretation and its understanding.
Okay. On staff has pointed out to me here on page 13, got a good graph there up at the top. Number of months between termination and rehire in the PERS system, and 1 month or less is 26%, and then the next largest percentage is over 2 years, is 28%. So it appears that roughly one quarter of the people are retiring, probably never cleaning off their desk and coming back to work the next day or shortly thereafter. And so you've got to wonder, is that person really in that category of, you know, professional that you couldn't have find somebody to fill the spot, or they're just taking advantage of the system.
Sure, if I may, that they could also be returning to a different position as well. I don't know. Without looking at these, and I think there's statistics that would bear out that many of those did go into the same job, but I don't think it's 100% of them. So
And then on the next page, page 14, you've got the top or the job classifications, and as you've mentioned, you know, biologists, various engineers, directors, peace officers. But then you get down to admin clerks, and I don't know, are we experiencing problems in hiring admin clerks?
Well, Mr. Chairman, and really looking at the data, this is one of the areas that we talked about. In going forward, where a hiring manager would have to document recruitment difficulty, and typically recruitment difficulty would mean that you have five or fewer candidates for a job, and I would speculate that you'd probably see fewer admin clerks in a program going forward than you see over, you know, based on, and this is 4 years worth of data too,
sure.
So I mean, nine out of over a 4 year period, but I think generally speaking, there is not a shortage of administrative clerks when you're trying to recruit for.
Okay, other questions from committee members? Go ahead.
Page 14, my wife is in the education business, and I know of a number of people, age irregardless, but no teacher's aide, there's five. Now, I assume this takes into account that in remote villages, and is that what we're looking at, where a person returns?
Page 14 is actually PERS, and there's a similar chart for the TERS, which would be your teaching profession.
I understand. It says teacher's aide. So I believe you'll find that a teacher's aide is under the PERS system because they're not a teacher qualified kind of person. So they're classified employees.
Correct.
Right?
They're not.
Put them under. Right. My point, though, is that normally speaking, good people, minimal qualification requirements.
Probably
long line of people that want into that job, and it just surprised me to see that sort of position having to rehire to people, because I just think of the community where I'm from, and I'm not saying it doesn't happen in remote areas and there's just a few people that line up for it, but it would really disappoint me in our community, because I've listened to people, golly, I want to get on, and if there are people that are being retained because you can't find somebody, my neighbors wouldn't like that.
A point well taken, and one that we've really been looking hard at.
Yeah, it may be a totally aberrational thing, and circumstances may be justified, but you understand when a person that is trying to get onto a minimal level qualification thing, that you got to look at when you're rehiring people.
Any other questions? Well, let's see, I was just checking with staff here. I did not keep a list here. We've asked you for some specific information. Did you just jot yourself notes there?
I have a couple things here, Senator, that I wrote down that we're going to provide for you, to the extent we could, a calculation of foregone contributions of rehires and their impact on the retirement system. We want to develop a chart for you on some age demographics of the HBT 42 retirees. Proactively try to determine who is advised in what manner. That's a little bit tougher one, but we'll make a stab at that as well. Those are the three things that I had highlighted.
Okay. And if we have you come back before us, would you be prepared to sort of suggest categories that need a heightened showing of need?
I think we could give you a list of job classifications in government that currently are experiencing recruitment difficulties. And the other thing, if I could, just as a follow-on comment, as we talked about the repercussions of if we did nothing and we had 400 or so people who potentially would have some sort of claim on what our exposure was. I mean, we have discussed that. I discussed it with the commissioner, and quite frankly, I think the feeling with the administration was that we'd rather not find that out. We'd rather provide the remedy because of the confusion there was with the program and fix that group, and then just make sure going forward that we have very clear and concise rules so that there's not a reoccurrence of the confusion.
Any other questions? And let's see, the Virginia Regal. Virginia here? Just wondering, has anything come up that you did anything come up that you just think needs to be clarified as far as the written opinion?
I don't think so at this time.
Okay. Well, if there's no further questions, I think that'll wrap things up for today. The bill on the Senate side has been introduced by Senator Gary Stevens. It's in the Hess Committee, and then it comes to State Affairs afterwards. I think after us, it probably goes to Finance. I had a conversation with Senator Green. She's interested in, what information we were able to gather, and I anticipate that Senator Dyson would be also. So with that, conclude for today. Heather, do you have the schedule for next week? Just to give you an idea, we will be scheduling meetings on Tuesday and Thursday of next week. We have four different bills on Tuesday and three bills on Thursday. Policy on general fund revenue shortfall, Senate Bill 88, Senate Bill 72, oaths, notaries, and the state seal, SER 2, Rotary International Year 2005, the Executive Order 113 relating to the TIC, that would be on Tuesday, and then Senate Bill 54, Protective Orders, Notice to Victims, that's on Thursday, Senate Bill 87, Seat Belt Violations as a Primary Offense, and Senate Bill 90, Alaska Territorial Guard Day. So those are things that will be new on the schedule next week. We will adjourn for the day.